through. We've got some stuff to get through and want to be able to have a good discussion. Do you have an 8 o'clock meeting too?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, I will need to leave right at 8 o'clock or a little bit before 8 o'clock because we do have standing committee meetings this morning at 8, which is the reason why we had to convene this so early. And I want to thank all of you that are here today for joining us. I know it's an early meeting, early morning meeting, but during the session, that's kind of all that we have time to be able to do that, or very late evening meetings. So really do appreciate your accommodations. One couple of things I wanted to bring up, and I'll do it next time too when we've got everybody here. But I want to set the stage and a demeanor of this commission moving forward. Becky and I have talked about this briefly. So that when people come to report to us as members of the commission, visit with them about the work that they're doing, there is some level of understanding for the importance of the work that we're doing. And I think part of that goes to title and office. And I will just reflect on other commissions upon which I sat. And we have addressed ourselves as commissioner, you know, because you have been appointed by the governor. There is a level of importance that I think needs to be shared with the broader community so that they understand that you were selected for a reason and that the work that we're doing is important. So I know that's going to take some getting used to, and I'm not going to, you know, beat up on people if you call each other by your first names. And I understand the familiarity and the relationship that occurs within this kind of work. But I'd like to try to work with each other to do that, because I think that, again, it sets the tone for when other individuals review the work that we do, and when we engage with them in whether it's the research committee, the communications committee, or the policy committee, you know, they understand that you are a commissioner. You have some authority presented to you by your appointment to this committee, to this commission. And so just know, I just don't want people being caught off guard when I address you that way, when we address you that way, because I think that your appointment affords some respect and some authority as you move forward into our community. So let me know if you have concerns or if you, again, Commissioner Burkholder.
Thank you. May I ask how the co-chairs would like to be addressed?
I would prefer by our office title, so representatives, and that would you do the same? And I guess the reason is that we have title, and I just felt that we have title, and people usually respond to us by title, but then we were being very familiar with other members of the commission, and I just feel very strongly that everybody is equally important, has equal stature on this committee, and I want to afford you the same respect. So, I'm ready.
Thank you.
So moving forward, I would like to take a motion to approve minutes and announcements. Has everybody had a chance to take a look at them, or shall we just take a second? Or? Do we have any other announcements to share with each other at this time?
Just as a follow-up to the roundtable with Secretary Perez, I thought that was a really interesting and good discussion. I appreciated everyone who was there and thought it was very, very interesting, and appreciated his perspective on some of the issues, both that we're facing here in Utah and kind of seeing that some of those are also national issues and how we fit into kind of some of the bigger movements and some things that are unique to us. So I thought it was great to have that chance to meet with him.
It was, and I liked the fact that we were able to get as many people that to join us that day. Our colleagues that came by, I was a little worried initially because not all of them were RSVPing. And I mean, I knew that it was a busy afternoon and there were a lot of things going on at the same time, but given that, the ones that did show up, even though it was a busy afternoon and there were three or four or five other things going on during the lunch hour, I was very pleased. And I think that also helps our commission moving forward and our colleagues understanding and appreciating the work that we're doing and giving us feedback, which I thought was extremely helpful. I don't know whether in the past year, notably neither Representative Edwards nor I have been attending with regularity the meetings that you've been convening, but I don't know if you've had that opportunity to have legislators see the work that we've already accomplished. So I think having that is kind of a kickoff to the new year, to our second year of work in a way, and having our colleagues there and other individuals there to see the work that the commission is doing and the discussions we've already started to have, and then to feed that. I mean, it was Representative Coleman's comment regarding voluntary work and do we count that, I think is a very notable, you know, important thing that we need to take a look at. And actually, I was talking with City Councilwoman Lisa Adams recently. She actually brought up the same thing in light of the recent press that we were getting about being the worst for women in the nation. She brought up that point. She says, well, what about those of us that have been, you know, we've got our degrees, but we opted to stay home. How do they count the work that we're doing? And so she just, Representative Coleman kind of reinforced that, and been thinking about how we can kind of bring that into the research work that we do. How do we quantify the many hours of volunteer work, of church work, of community work, that women who necessarily aren't in the workforce are contributing, and those valuable hours? And I think maybe having the Nonprofits Association maybe in the future kind of help us quantify that and feed that discussion might be helpful. So a couple of things that I took away from that. Yes, Commissioner?
I just wanted to add also, thank you, Representative, that you know, the work that we do in our different areas, women, whether it's business or politics or whatever, that is true when it comes to families. What's the outcome of women staying home and raising families? It's not just that they're staying home. It's, you're right, that there's very much so an impact that's being made. I think it's an important one. We wouldn't want 100% participation rate in employment. What would that do to our families?
Good point. So let's think through how we might want to move forward with that. And I think that'll also help the broader community understand the work of this commission is not solely being workforce driven. I mean, it's contribution driven, but that there are economic impacts regardless of what contributions a woman chooses to make or does make in her community, either as a member of the workforce or in the non-unpaid workforce, because those of us that worked for nonprofits or nonprofit organizations know very clearly that we wouldn't be able to do the work that we do if not for, you know, the volunteers that support us. So let's think that through. Any more comments, Ms. Commissioner?
Representative Chavez-Houck, I wonder whether the, isn't there a Utah Commission on Volunteers? Mm-hmm. Do they gather the any of that data?
I was on that commission for about 3 years.
Do they gather any data about, gendered data about the unpaid contributions of volunteers?
I don't know about gender.
We could check into that.
If I may.
Yes.
I know that the Family and Consumer Studies Department at the University of Utah does a lot of work on unpaid family as a contribution to the economy. So I'm writing down notes, and I'd like to take this back to the research
subcommittee. Yeah, and see what they, that'd be great. Thank you.
I think the way we discuss this and the way we frame this within the greater context of our work has potential to lessen the divide on this issue. Sometimes it can be an emotional one for people, and I think finding a way to validate and appreciate those contributions, I think, would really go a long way to bridging that.
Yeah, I agree. And that comment that Representative Coleman made kind of shook me, I mean, kind of was a wake-up call a little bit for me about, okay, gauging some, would I say, questioning some of my preconceived thoughts about where, what we might want to do with the commission and looking at the totality of contributions that women make in our community. So initially I was kind of like, oh, and then I thought, no, she's right, we need to look at this.
Yeah.
Any other comments either on our visit with Secretary Perez or other things that we've been doing before we move on? Great. Commissioner Thompson has some information regarding women and speaking out on LinkedIn, so why don't you share that with us?
I felt it was something, thank you, to share with our commission. We've heard from many speakers and, of course, in our own research. But there was an article, and of course it was written by Sheryl Sandberg, who is well-known with women's rights and different things. She had written an article, and it was where I saw it was on LinkedIn, called Speaking While Female. And she had mentioned a few things. She gave an example of some female writers with the Shield who weren't speaking up in brainstorming meetings, writing meetings. And the reason for that, when he asked them, was that they were shut down and interrupted consistently and felt like if they had a good idea that it was taken by somebody else and ran with it. So he changed the rules of the meetings where you weren't allowed to interrupt someone and that everyone was able to speak freely. And so that actually helped the women to be able to share what they thought and their opinions as well. He talked about women speaking in professional settings and how they feel like they walk a tightrope. And also he mentioned a Yale study where women in public speaking and professional speaking, that when they spoke up, their ratings were actually declining. And where men would speak up, their ratings would increase. And so it did talk about the same that was going on in healthcare and their performance evaluations, where a woman would speak up and be rated lower than before she had spoken up. They also find, I guess the article was really about finding ways to interrupt the gender bias. And also they had mentioned specifically that President Obama at last year, I think it was the end of the year, had a news conference and only invited women reporters, and it made world news. Although, you know, just their gender shouldn't have really done that, but it is different than what is the norm. They also talked about increasing the number of women in leadership roles, how the leader should be encouraging other women, like we are, for leadership roles. Also, it talked about how men are very confident, but women are very competent. And also, as we become more accustomed to having women in leadership roles, that tends to change, where the more women we have in the workplace, especially industries where women do have a bigger presence than others, where that's not as male-dominated, that they're more accustomed to that, and the ratings don't drop when a woman speaks up. I thought that was worth mentioning for our commission. Any questions? Of course, we now share.
Would you share that with us? Would you send that, share that with us?
Uh-huh.
Super. Thank you. Auditor Dougal.
I do have a question.
Yes.
So, Commissioner, if you could just elaborate, you indicated they feel like they're on a tightrope. What is that tightrope?
Well, from the article, it's probably because they are aware of the feelings that people have and the ratings, where if they do speak up, they may not feel that it's being welcomed, if that makes sense.
Gotcha.
And so they, and women, I think, and this is my personal opinion, is they may feel like they don't want to offend. And so men have a lot of confidence, although women are increasing in that. I think that's probably why. I hope that answers your question.
Especially if they feel that they're going to, knowing that that might impede how they're ranked or rated among their peers or in evaluations, it's second guessing before you think about speaking versus just laying it out there because you think it's a good idea. You have to think, okay, am I going to use the political capital that I have in this situation to say this comment, or should I wait till I got my real nugget that I want to share with everyone? So that's probably kind of another piece of clarity.
They also mentioned that when men with more power in legislation, interestingly, would spend more time speaking on the floor than a woman with the same amount of power would. It's interesting how often we feel we should and can and ought to speak up.
If I might, I go.
Some people speak too long.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Although I think what's really interesting with that is that also it'd be interesting to know whether this is validated by research at all, but I think sometimes since women are the ones that want to kind of share the turn, I know that I do that as a leader, as a caucus leader. I mean, I might have a comment to make on a piece of legislation, but I might think, okay, I've already spoken two or three times. Is there somebody in my team that hasn't had a chance to speak on the floor that I want to nurture as a potential leader that also has that expertise and that perspective, additional perspective, to shed light to the body? And so I might defer to that person, a man or a woman, not even thinking about the gender and thinking, okay, I want another member of my team to have that opportunity to speak versus me popping up every time.
But then what does that say when people think, well, they're the leader, that leader, she's not getting up and saying things. So it's a good thing to think about. Thanks for sharing that with
us. Thank you for letting me.
Before we move to our committee updates, I wanted to go off the agenda for just a minute and first of all, welcome Auditor Dougal for joining us today. And we didn't really do introductions, so I don't know whether you know everybody that's here. So let's take a quick second to do that so you know the members of the commission that are here, what role they play, why they've been invited to serve. So Commissioner Burkholder, if you would please start and then we'll walk around.
I'm Ann Burkholder. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the YWC.
Carrie Main, I'm the Director of Workforce Research and Analysis inside Workforce Services and the Chief Economist.
I'm Judy Barnett, I'm the Executive Director of the Utah Labor Community Services and AFL-CIO Service.
I'm Anne-Marie Thompson with the Salt Lake Chamber Women's Business Center, and I represent small business at the, on the commission.
I'm Gail Tilson, and I'm Carrie's assistant.
So Commissioner Selig had contacted Auditor Dougal to do some research as a follow-up to the discussion that we had last week from the interior designers from where they came and spoke to some of the challenges that they're having in the regulatory vein. And afterwards we got to thinking, are there certain segments of types of industry work, areas of licensure that are predominated by women in those particular pieces of industry? What do those regulatory frameworks look like? Is there kind of a preponderance of this, what I would say, mission creep by other industries that jump on top of, for lack of a better way of putting it, on other industries that might be predominated by women licensed professionals? I believe that's kind of the scope where Representative/Commissioner Selig had asked you to assist us, John. So do you want to take a second and talk a little bit about what you found so far and maybe give us a little bit of background about specifically what she asked you to
sure,
do?
Sure. So she came to visit with me. It was about 2 weeks ago, maybe 2.5 weeks ago. And we talked about a couple different things about women in the economy and so forth. But one of the key things she brought up is when it came to licensure, whether it's business licensure or professional licensure, are we placing too many barriers in the way? Is government going above and beyond what is necessary for health and safety issues and creating a disincentive, especially for women, to enter the economy or to expand whatever business they're in just because of these hurdles? And so we have not, typically for us to do an audit, it takes a little bit of time before we can engage on that. So we're just in the early stages of collecting some information. That's part of the reason I'm here, is to see, are there other aspects of that? So some examples that she brought up were interior design work. And is it really necessary for an architect to have to approve everything that they're doing? And to what extent is that overkill? She brought up issues related with child care, daycare, and other things like that. And sometimes the cost of the various different licenses that take place and the various different reviews that take place start to add up. So someone says, well, that's 1 or 2 months of just my revenue just covering those costs. And are those costs appropriate or are those costs excessive? And so, you know, I'm probably here to get input from you of on if we looked at that, what other aspects we should look at. I'll give you one other thing she didn't bring up, but my son is a firefighter, and there's always that example that they bring up that says it takes fewer hours to become a firefighter than it does to become, you know, a hairstylist. And so, you know, did we go overkill on the one end relative to the other? And so you'll hear that quite regularly. We heard that in the legislature about braiding hair and so forth. The number of hours required to get that license versus other activities in the economy. So I'll just kind of do that intro and throw that out because I'm open for any suggestions or things that we should watch for. Along the same lines, we've also gotten complaints from other folks, you know, just about the cost of licensure and the reach of government into business. So.
Are you seeing, though, kind of a trend line at all related to any specific industries?
We have not looked yet.
So this is the beginning.
This is the beginning.
Okay. So, you know, if any of you have heard of other types of work please let Carrie know, and we can, or myself, and we can just cast and share that with Auditor Google. Do you have cards with you by chance?
I don't, but okay. I can run upstairs and bring
some. No, that's
down.
Okay. What we'll do is make sure that you get, that Gail gets your contact information,
yeah,
and you can send it to the rest of the commissioners with a request if they have, if other commissioners have other industries that they would like you to take a look at, to feel free to let you know.
You know, one of the things that, as you, just as you were talking, a thought I had on this was some of these industries, you know, you mentioned cosmetology, you mentioned childcare, and I wonder if there is a move in some of those areas to validate or to make, rather than from the outset making it be too, the intent is not necessarily to make it be too oppressive or too difficult barrier, but to, in order to validate and say, you know, is this, maybe anyone could do cosmetology, any kind of gray hair, anyone could do this, but in order to ramp up the level of, like legitimacy within a field that maybe is predominantly women, maybe that's a move that traditionally women have been happy to have happen within that field, thinking, okay, this adds a stamp of legitimacy and a stamp of approval to our profession here. I mean, not the interior design example, that clearly is different here, but I'm wondering if that initially had been embraced in some ways, because, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no,
says,
I didn't.
Okay, this, the state has said, not everybody can do this thing, whatever this is. Not everyone can run childcare facility out of their home, and most of us women are doing this, and how do we get the state to say, we're legitimate, we matter, this is a big deal.
There's training, there's expertise.
That's right, which there is in all of those things, but to the extent that it maybe then goes too far and ends up being a barrier for other people trying to enter the very same profession. And are there other ways for women in those small businesses, kind of some of those areas, to receive the same kind of acknowledgement, I guess, from either professional organizations or the state, without having these onerous kind of barrier regulatory entry kind of things? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think if I were to summarize some of Representative Seelig's comments, one thing would be, she did bring up kind of the difference between part-time versus full-time. And maybe some of these costs are reasonable for a full-time activity, but when you factor in many want just do part-time, do they become onerous in that sense? And then there was the discussion about, you know, health and safety related issues, where she felt like that's clearly a role of government versus did they go above and beyond that. We didn't really branch out into, you know, kind of more what you're describing there.
It's so, credentialing a little bit. I
yeah.
like the legitimacy things, and I'll take a look at that.
So, I mean, there is the, do a tangent for just a second. There's a regulatory capture concept. It's loosely described as the bootleggers and the Baptists. And if you think of prohibition, you have those folks that make the moral case for a certain regulation or a certain, you know, statutory activity. And then you have those that make the money in the deal and stuff. And so you will see that time and time again. And when it comes to licensure, those that make whatever moral case of why licensure needs to take place versus those that piggyback on, and I'm more than happy to put, if you will, the folks making the moral case front and center, because they're going to make money in the deal somehow.
Yeah.
And so we always have to be careful and watch for those kind of activities from that perspective.
Any other thoughts or comments or ideas fleshing out that research?
Well, I was married to a firefighter. Congratulations. Okay. And when we got married, he was a boot.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and you know what that terminology is. And also, my mother was a cosmetology, and I'm looking at the analogy of the way it is. And
I'm not saying my analogy. I'm just saying when I was in the legislature, it was time and time. That was the example.
Yeah.
Oh, it's 2,000 hours here versus 700 hours here.
It's a terrible, terrible example, because, I mean, good laws, as a boot, I mean, the first 4 years, the 5 years of going into the fire department, you're constantly physically and mentally in books and training, and who knows, the Hotel Newhouse burnt down when we were married, okay, he came home with a singed t-shirt. However, cosmetology is they're working on the head and the bones and on the muscles and all of this and all the different things they have to do, and so they're apprenticing for all those years. But I would be curious as to, and also in the 70s, I had a child care provider in the home that
you're hitting them all. Have you ever worked part-time as an interior designer?
You know, and you
were decorated your own house.
You know, and I had my home feng shui when I moved into my new condo because I wanted everything just perfect. And she wasn't licensed, and she was amazing. And I think that she placed everything in a good energy like 12 years ago, and I love it. So I would be curious at the hours versus the hours, or the hours for licensing. In my world, of course, in the labor movement, we have licensed electricians by the state of Utah, plumbers, but in the laborers and in the iron workers, they don't have licenses, you know. So I would just be curious if the example of the amount of hours that they say, a cosmetologist, what are the total hours, versus if they're going to keep comparing the firefighters, I don't think they stop using the word boot for a while. Poor guys. They're the ones out there holding the boot, getting the money for the MS.
Am I not describing the example correctly?
No,
I'm beginning to bring up in the legislature?
Yeah. And I think your presentation the other day, I just listened to you on the air of in the environment, the EPA. It was wonderful, and I heard someone in the background say, oh, I think we get that.
Yeah.
Because you spoke their language, the majority language of the town. It was very well. But back to I'd just be curious at the hours. And maybe because I grew up in this kind of environment, I just, no, the hours my mother put in and the hours that my husband put in. Hours. So I don't know. What is that? They're going to continue to compare that.
I think that there's another level of analysis that might connect with some of the work that you did earlier in the year, and that has to do with choice of occupation. And is there a way to look at the occupations that are chosen primarily by women for whatever reason? It's just data. And analyze which of those occupations require a license, not just of women, but of all occupations. Which occupations are primarily occupied by women? And is there disparity in the licensing requirements? Or is there some way in which women in those occupations that require licenses are disadvantaged? So it's an exploration of whether there are licensing barriers attached to gendered occupations, at least the way we.
Right, and building on that, it could be the number of hours, it could be the cost involved, could be the process or the supervision required, all of those. And I think on that as well, you could look at some of the fields that individuals who are going through the UCAT system are entering those fields and
Exactly.
those are
very closely to the UCAT. Absolutely.
Yeah. And my expectation there is that we're not getting as many women going through, especially in the UCAT area. And though that's really an underutilized resource in terms of training for women, I think.
Can I ask a question? Just out of curiosity, I'm an engineer by background.
Ooh.
So let me do just a little poll if I could.
Okay.
Who here thinks engineering is conducive to women versus who thinks it's not as an industry? Just kind of curious.
In terms
just
in terms of openness to engaging women in the industry, or just by
a couple things run through my mind is does a woman want to join that industry regardless of her intellect or ability? And then the intellect or ability to do so. Because if it's male-dominated, women sometimes shy away from that, although they could be competent enough to do it. I'm not sure if women, and it might be that younger girls who are deciding what they want to do are either, like, I guess the same thing, they kind of shy away from that, or they're encouraged maybe in other ways. That's what goes through my mind, so it's not a really direct answer, but those are the two things I think of. Is, does it look like a place I could find myself, or is it, could I do it? Those two things I think are very separate.
And yes, for me, because I've been working with Stan Lockhart on the STEM project, prior to that, I knew one person 10 years ago who was an engineer, and I thought, oh my gosh, you're female. So I have been very well educated in what we're trying to do at the high schools and preparing these young women to go into all fields through the STEM program. And they're working with us in the labor organization as well. So I have an 8-year-old granddaughter who's very interested in being an engineer.
Okay.
Do
you have something representative?
My short answer is no. I don't think it traditionally is seen that way. Yeah.
And actually, it's really interesting. Commissioner Selig and I had this conversation about a couple months ago, because she had talked to, and I believe they were water engineers, a group of women that specialize in water. And she had mentioned that she had talked to them, and they had talked about a lot of hostility in the industry, just in terms of when they show up to meetings, when they show up for consultations, this assertion of, why are you here? You know, kind of that initial vibe that they get. And it was that where they talked about when they were going through school, nobody ever told them of the possible hostility they might find in the industry. I mean, they were just doing their coursework, and they were focused, and their professors were great, and their colleagues were great, their peer colleagues were great. But then when they went into the workforce, that's when they got the wall. That's when they, you know, there was the kind of question of, I don't understand what you're doing here type of demeanor from other, probably more established folks in the field. And so I think it's the continued challenge of breaking through whenever you've got pioneers, so to speak, and there isn't a preponderance of a certain gender in a particular industry or a certain area of licensure, that there is kind of that. There is that kind of little boys network that exists, and it takes a bit to break in through it. And sometimes some women do get tired of it. I mean, it's like, you know, we've been fighting this battle for how long? The more that there are more women that show up to the table, then the concentration starts to change and the makeup starts to change. And I think it'll be maybe generational too, that the overlay on that. But I reflect, it was kind of interesting that you asked that, because back in 1977, when I was looking at possible careers, my mother wanted me to go into engineering. I mean, she loved math. The woman was decades ahead of her time. She was born ahead of herself in so many ways. And I think that in 1938, when she graduated from high school, she would have loved to have been able to do that. But they did not have the resources to send her to college. Her family did not. And but she had the intellectual capacity to have been able to probably really excelled in that field. So, you know, our parents always want us to do what they weren't able to do. I have to tell you that I am just totally math averse, and it's not because, and I know I am. I mean, it's just, and my strength is in the humanities, and in that the other sphere of my brain is just stronger. And so it was just really interesting, because even back then she was like, I don't know why you, she says, you will be able to make so much more money than where you're going with this. And she just really saw it as a career capacity opportunity for me, totally. But it's really intriguing how even back then she saw the opportunity that existed. But here we are 40 years later, and we're still kind of having these discussions about, you know, the challenges that still exist. So that's a long answer to your question, but just kind of a notable thought.
Well, I partly ask it because I work with many women in engineering, and they describe it as how family friendly it can be, and rewarding, and other activities. But part of it is, if I were to describe what they're saying, is there's this bias of self-selection away from it, just from the outside, the perception of what it is, versus when you get in the breadth of opportunities that just that education provides. You may do your classical engineering versus marketing versus sales versus all sorts of other activities, and how it's such a good educational foundation that they're just surprised that more shy away from it for whatever reason.
And it might be a misperception. I mean, we may be hearing from a couple of women that, you know, this is what their experience is and it needs to be validated. But what you're saying is there are other women that have had positive experiences, and maybe what we need to do is find more women who have had those positive experiences to share that with other young women in the communities.
I have one additional comment, if that's okay. And it's just popped in my mind with the very last thing that you had said, and it's an event that's coming up. I oversee a Business Women's Forum group, and we are doing a STEM breakfast in March just for that purpose, to have women who are professional bring their daughters with them to breakfast to just listen to women who are in those fields. And it's not as scary as you think, and it's good. And it's, you know, a woman can do it. And so we hope that those girls will remember that, and if they're a certain age, they probably will.
True.
And it may be a pivotal time where I went to a breakfast with my mom.
I never even thought about that.
And
ooh,
yeah, I heard this lady talk about being in engineering or in science or math, and I thought I could do it. So anyway, that's something that we're doing with the Salt Lake.
What day is that again?
It'll be on the 18th of March at the University of Utah in the...
If you don't have other speakers,
in the
like,
union
if you need somebody, let me know.
Yeah.
I know we have a panel. I will let our committee know about that.
Where do you sign up?
You sign up online at slchamber.com/BWF. Yeah. That's something that's crossed our minds, and I think it could be something that's really important where, you know, inspiring girls when they're younger, when they remember, especially where there's a transition to where things are more acceptable now than they have been in the past.
Uh-huh.
And hopefully, even moving forward, there's even more open doors. So.
Will you share that date with the commission and the link to the rest of the commissioners?
Mm-hmm.
And let's cascade that out. That's a wonderful
idea.
If you like math and science, there's something going on down at Utah Valley University in March, which is a Saturday event, which is like a science fair type of thing. It'll look kind of interesting. So.
Great. Super. Any other thoughts?
I just wanted to remind the commission, the two of you may not know because it was occurring before you were co-chairs, but we have been working with Tammy Getz from the STEM Action Center, and she's moving forward full steam with the Million Mentors Program, which is maybe pinging off of what Anne-Marie talked about.
We're co-working with them.
Yeah, and that's a little bit more toward the older group, right, because it's about the transition from school into the workforce and helping women feel as though they've got a connection point and a place to go for, you know, understanding. So.
Let me mention one other thing. We're in the process of this, but you know, it probably wouldn't surprise you, but we're looking at high school performance versus what people graduated in college, just to do that analysis. And part of it is from everybody's talking so much about STEM. The assumption is you probably had to be good at STEM stuff in high school to have any success with STEM in college, but we were surprised that nobody had really done this analysis in Utah. So we're starting to do this analysis. But as you would suppose, you're not going to do STEM in college if you weren't somehow successful with it in high school. So you have to have some foundation going into college. So, and we're using, for example, ACT as a surrogate for high school performance, because that at least gives us a level playing field across.
I'm just curious, are you using the Utah Data Alliance data to do that?
We're working with the commissioner's office.
Okay.
So you know David Sternfeld, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, David's doing that analysis. We hope to release that in the next month or so.
Well, again, if you think of any other things that you want Auditor Dougal to kind of zone in on as he continues to do his research, please let him know. Let us know. We can go ahead and share that with him moving forward. We appreciate your help with this.
Sure.
Look forward to what your findings are.
There's one other little thing. There is a bill that Workforce Services is working on. I don't know if you're aware of this. Currently, we have a limitation for education assistance of 24 months. And so they're working to lift that restriction so it at least is 36 months in line with the federal number.
Okay.
And so the bill has actually bounced among a couple of folks, and I don't know if it's settled down or if it's still in flux.
Okay.
So that's just kind of the status of where it's at. And I don't know what the concerns are and why it's moved around to different sponsors. I think it's on its fifth potential sponsor right now.
Interesting.
So
Wow.
So I.
Well, if they need somebody, so I'm sure that there's someone
else. I mean, where is it now?
I think it's currently with Representative Stemmuck, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
But that he hasn't agreed to run it. I think he's looking at it. John Pierpont can give. He can tell you who exactly.
Okay.
So that was my recollection.
Yeah, especially since you're chair, because it would probably go through your committee, right?
Yeah, this is not an issue that we heard, although it does kind of ring a bell. That is it related to the fact that if you have the fewer number of hours that, the 24 months limits you in terms of what you're able to study, because some programs go beyond that, and
is it mostly
matching the federal programs?
Well, so right now we're more restricted than the federal allowance. But the concern is probably who it impacts the most are, my assumption is single mothers with kids. It makes it really hard for them. Within 24 months.
It's through TANF.
But for 24 months to really get a meaningful certificate or associate's degree in that period of time, which means it's kind of biased, if you will, where we get a little more assistance, they're not. And so this is one of the things that Speaker Lockhart and Representative Seelig were working on. And it's one of those things that was kind of an outstanding issue that I was following up on just to kind of see where it's at.
Okay. I have some information. I was told if it comes up, be sure that you have this information on hand. Currently, the code, blah, 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 limits needy families to 24 months of benefits. The federal regulations allow for 36 months. So DWS desires to remove that so that we just default to the 30-month federal limitation. The families who would be most affected are at 60% of the federal poverty level, so they're making about $12,000 a year. And
doesn't it also say single-parent families?
Yes, it's also important to note the majority of the recipients are single parents.
So it says single-parent families, mm-hmm. which causes me to say it's most likely women that would benefit from the change.
Thank you for looking at that too, yes.
And I think the other aspect of that, which you may not have heard, is that there are regulations apparently within the department or a practice within the department not to
encourage them down
encourage women to
you can't succeed in 24 months, so don't even
try. That's exactly right. To encourage women, to discourage women from pursuing education because their assistance was only for 24 months and that would get them through a program. So
that was our practice,
which doesn't conform to the
rule.
That's
what I heard as well.
So it's really, I think, an important,
very counterintuitive, I guess, for the film that it doesn't need. Alrighty, any other thoughts? Well, thank you again.
Appreciate your time
for the work. Appreciate that. Look forward to what you find. Well, we're getting close to the ending hour, but I do want to, a couple of things that I wanted to do. Carrie, I wanted to ask you about where we're at with the research on the wage gap and where that's going.
So we continue to do data cleaning.
Okay.
We actually met with Matthew Weinstein.
Oh, okay.
For those of you that don't know, Matthew is with Voices for Utah Children, and he did Voices wage gap.
Okay.
He and work with his intern, I believe,
yep.
from the University of Utah Economics Department. So we met with Matthew to coordinate. As we move forward, we wanted to ensure that we weren't duplicating or are going to have challenging results, results that challenge each other on that wage gap study. But we continue, we have it on Natalie's priority list as our top priority right now, so she's just continuing that work. It's going to be a pretty complicated model, so she's done a lot of work in researching the optimal model and cleaning the data, so we continue to move on with that. Jennifer Robinson also told me to let everyone know, she apologizes for not being able to make it, but she has focused on just getting the committee put together. There have been some suggestions from the last meeting on additional subcommittee members, and she's got all of those people on board. They're listed in the minutes, except she's still waiting to hear back from the BYU connection, I think.
Okay.
So that's the one thing. And then she wants to have the first subcommittee meeting after the legislative session.
Sounds good.
Right. I do also have a update from the communications subcommittee if you want me to read through that.
Fine, thank you.
So chair of the subcommittee, Commissioner Barnum, sent an update to me to share with all of you. The first meeting for the communications subcommittee is February 24th at Salt Lake Chamber, and she continues, her roster is all filled, but for, she wants to work with you to identify someone that will represent the diversity communications aspect.
Great.
The intended agenda for the first strategy session will be to set the top three communication priorities. She's going to base it on our past matrix, the bill, and then the research that's been done. Identify key audiences. Form messaging for audiences. Brainstorm tactics that align with the purpose of the commission. Identify possible channels of communication. And then create assignments and action items. Community members still desired. Oh, I'm sorry. I guess she does still have some to set. We said the diversity representative, someone from LDS employment, she's reached out but doesn't have a name yet. DHS, UDOT, and UBU or SLCC.
Can you help me by connecting with her and asking her to ask Olga De La Cruz? She's an associate director with the Hispanic Chamber, Utah Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and I think she'd really be a great addition to this team. Any other subcommittee reports to share? All righty. Is there any other business to come before the commission? Oh, Matthew, do you want to introduce yourself really quickly? I meant to have you introduce you and your daughter when you first came in and we were
sure.
In a really good discussion.
So I'm Matthew Weinstein, and I'm at Voices for Utah Children, and I took the position vacated by Tracy Gruber when she went to work at DWS. So I'm picking up on a lot of the work that she had done, and actually one of the first things that Karen Crompton, who hired me last summer, said that we've got to help out with is the research on the gender gap. So that's where we've been working with the economics department, and they provided a bunch of interns, and one in particular that worked on that report that came out last month, which of course a lot was, you know, just duplicating, repeating the great work that the folks at DWS have done. But we're delighted to be able to support what you're doing and contribute in whatever modest way we can to the work of the commission.
And who's joining?
Oh, and so this is Rachel, my daughter. She's in fifth grade at McGillis, which is closed today. They make President's Day a four-day weekend.
Oh,
so it turned into Take Your Daughter to Work Day.
Wonderful. Oh, good for you. How fun is that? How do you like the walls in Voices for Utah Children? Do you like the color of the walls? Yeah, my son-in-law painted those while we were in the law school. I used to work for Voices. I worked part-time for Karen Crompton back in 2005 or 6 or something.
Wow,
yeah, so we painted that. Those walls are pretty pretty, huh?
So did everyone get a copy of your report?
I do have a couple of hard copies.
Yeah. Does anybody missing?
Probably. Are they on your website?
Please.
Yes,
okay.
They are on our
I'd like to have a hard copy.
I'll tell you. Yeah. Great. Let me pass those down.
Representative Edwards, do you have anything that you might want to add as we get ready to close?
I don't. I do notice that the only subcommittee without a report is the one that you and I both sit on. I didn't want to call either of us out, but someone needs
to.
Yeah,
we'll have that. We'll make sure we have that for next time.
We will, and I was so happy to see neither of us were the chair of the subcommittee, so we will have to get on
Commissioner
Seelig. Chair Commissioner Seelig. thank you. For everyone for being
yes,
here.
I appreciate that. And what we'll just go ahead and do in terms of the next meeting, since there's so few, not everybody's here, Gail, if you'll go ahead and just let's work on a doodle poll looking at that for next month, we'll go forward with that. All right, thanks everyone for your presentation.
I wanted you to see it. I've never watched Blind Joe. But it's getting into our lives, and her name is
every
month. She does
our
driving.
She's
going around.
We've some very...
Oh, okay.
impressive journalist.
And I think one of the things I wanted to do is try to meet everybody, especially last week. We've only got a little more year left of the commission, so
trying to take advantage of our time to
Oh, you're welcome.
Jones is a Republican. She's a Democrat.
But I know more.
And it's this and I just love it. Because he tries not to. But anyway, this morning she was talking about her book and going out. And they were also talking about what you just said. When they're in meetings, not speaking out. There's a CEO of a big, huge corporation. And they said, she was working internally, and they said they